and welcome to The Last Horror Podcast. My name's Christopher Brown. This week, what I want to do is really help you out, give you a warning, make sure that you're okay and safe.
I am the spirit of dark and lonely water, ready to trap the unwary, the show-off, the fool. And this is the kind of place you'd expect to find me. But no one expects to find me here. It seems too ordinary. But that pool is deep. The boy is showing off. The bank is slippery. The show-offs are easy. But the unwary ones are easier still. This branch is weak, rotten. It'll never take his weight. Only a fool would ignore this. But there's one born every minute. Under the water there are traps. Old cars, bedsteads, weeds, hidden depths. It's the perfect place for an accident.
Oh, look, there's someone in the water. Quick, give us that big stick to get him out.
Sensible children. I have no power over them.
Oi, mate, that's a stupid place to swim. Hey, go over and get that thing to wrap him in. You don't have to feel cold, mate. How long was you in there?
Ew, awful thing.
I'll be back.
Or, alternatively, absolutely fucking terrify you. This week we look at the public information film, a very British tradition, although one that is replicated around the world. See, public information films are effectively government-commissioned short films. They sit in our childhoods, terrifying us, reminding us of the evils of the world. They still exist today, but in the 70s and 80s, there was a particularly vicious front to them. I always remember myself as a child, sitting on a bench in the school assembly, ready to watch a film. Back then we'd be watching it on what must have been 16mm film, maybe 8, but in my mind it was obviously a big projector. And these 16mm films normally were things like, I don't know, Escape from Witch Mountain or something similar to that. We did have, you know, video and VHS, but every now and again this projector came out to show us something. Invariably it was a public information film. It was my first introduction to the idea that the world could be a dangerous place. I saw... The one that always sticks in the mind is a Stranger Danger film. A little bit of research discovered that the film was actually called Say No to Strangers from 1981. A film directed by John McKenzie. Now, John McKenzie is actually well known in British film. He directed Apaches, which is a film we'll talk about in a bit. But also a number of Play for Todays. And also The Long Good Friday, the fantastic classic gangster film starring Bob Hoskins. The film itself, you know, this was the film he did immediately afterwards, alarmingly. A 15-minute short, bemoaning the idea that just because people are, you know, you can spot the good guys and the bad guys normally in the world film. In reality, you know, the banality of evil, people out there can look different to how they actually are. And obviously, they're the type of people you'd want to avoid.
We're bound to find that car soon. Susie's description was quite clear.
But supposing you don't find it in time? She might be badly hurt. Or dead. Supposing she's dead.
Well, Teresa wasn't dead, but something very nasty had happened to her.
And he was all right to you in the car, was he? Didn't say anything else?
No.
And what happened when you went inside the house?
First he was all nice to me, gave me cakes and sweets. And then he tried to touch me, tried to take my clothes off. I said I didn't like it.
And what happened then?
He tried to kiss me, and he hurt my arm.
Oh, poor Teresa. That was when you shouted out, was it?
I shouted out, zombie come. It was horrible.
Mackenzie's obviously a fantastic filmmaker because I still remember this film. And I must have been 6, 7 years old. I remember sitting on the wooden benches. I remember the projector screen up. I remember it being quite a jarring experience. For when you're a child, 15 minutes can feel like a long time. And it felt like an epic, constantly warning and bashing away of how bad these people were. But public information films weren't always like that. They started in the Second World War, when Richard Massingham, who was an amateur actor who realised there was a gap in the market for the creation of these kind of films. They could provide from anything from How to Cross the Road to How to Survive a Nuclear Attack. Now, Massingham's stuff initially came about because he was, you know, creating films to kind of improve on the war effort. His films weren't the dark kind of bleakness. They matched a different tone because people were more there were bigger horrors out there at the time. So his tone was quite quirky and silly and funny, suggesting little things you can do to help the war effort.
You have certainly seen thousands like this. They're not a nuisance. They're a real danger. Hi, stop it, you. Stop it. Stop it. Come here. What do you think you're up to? You've probably infected thousands of people already. What do you think this is for? Yes, that's all right, but here's another way of using your handkerchief. Now sneeze. Come on. All right, never mind. Close your eyes.
Now, these films continued with the Central Office of Immigration, which is now closed, providing things like private contractors and, you know, out-of-work actors and directors, people looking for work, to create these short films. Then they were supplied to broadcasters free of charge, so they could use them whenever they had a gap to fill. Now, what this meant was public information broadcast films were filler in the advert breaks, or when TV shows ran a little short. So they would be put on to, you know, effectively, you know, during quiet times. And normally, you know, these times could be when children's TV programs were on. And this ran through the 60s, 70s, and much of the 80s. And these films themselves, for me, carried a certain a feel for the time. So it's not that surprising, therefore, that these filler programs are times of worry and concern from the public, and, you know, the Cold War matched the darkness. In many ways, their aim, particularly in the 70s and early 80s, was to scare people, scare them into the actions that they wanted. The Central Office for Information actually closed at the end of 2011 after 65 years and no longer make these public information films. But certain groups still do, such as National Rail and the NSPCC. These films are still used in a way. But today what I do want to do is focus on a particular section of time, a period when films were quite frightening. Now, I started this podcast with a clip from a 1.5-minute film called Lonely Water. Now, for many, this could almost be seen as being almost folk horror-y, the personification of the environment around us. Lonely Water was produced by Illustria Films and directed by Jeff Grant. And it was based on following the concerns that were based after children dying in cold water, falling into a lake, and then their heart going. Donald Pleasance is the voice of the water, warning of its murky depths, and also kind of almost being pleased that it could drag these children in. There's a stillness to the film. And I thought that, you know, and a reiteration that sensible children, clever children, children that you would want to be, would not be sucked into the depths. And at the end, what it does is promise something else, that another fool will come along and it will claim a victim. Dark and Lonely Water is a horror in a sense. Its badness, its its protagonist, its force, is based on nature itself, the environment, coming up and encapsulating and attacking that child. And for me, there's a paranoia that sits behind it. A paranoia that effectively follows a lot of these kind of films. And the thing about something like Apaches is that it's a strange, strange film. It's also not short. I mean, you'd normally expect a public information film to be, you know, 5 or 10 minutes. But much in the same way that Say No to Strangers that I watched as a child was 15, Apaches get apart nearly half an hour long. As I said, directed by John McKenzie and written by Neville Smith. Now, Neville Smith is a talented writer. He was born in Liverpool in 1940 and worked as a teacher, but then became involved in drama and took part in a number of radio dramas. He's in the Doctor Who story, The Reign of Terror, as well. And as well as appearing in things like, you know, Zed Cars and whatnot. He was known as, you know, his writing included in a lot of Play for Today kind of stuff. So Play for Today, Long Distance Information. He also wrote After a Lifetime on ITV, some of Gumshoe, and The Manageress as well, another TV series. So he worked in TV and acted. So it's not that surprising, therefore, that Apaches is surprisingly intense and also surprisingly well structured as a narrative. This isn't just a, you know, sharp, sharp shock. It's not a 30-second flash, such as the classic warning to not to pick up sparklers after they've been dropped, which is 30 seconds, the child reaches down and it's covered in bandages. Apaches has a proper narrative about a number of children that walk onto a farm and are playing as if they are Native American Indians in the Westerns. These six kids go on, and throughout the film, these Apache warriors, as they were, die in violent and shocking accidents, mainly due to the children's lack of care on the farm, which they shouldn't be on in the first place. And not only that, the actual closing credits show a long list of real children who'd actually died in farm accidents in the year before the film was made. It's incredibly brutal. It involves a funeral at the end, and it's surprising in the amount it wishes to shock and horrify its audience. It's a sharp, sharp shock, and a successful one. The film wasn't just shown in UK, but also in places in Canada and Australia and the United States. I think the interesting thing about Apaches is that there's another part you could equally argue the fact that the kids are, you know, it gives them the right or the information to kind of do what they do. You know, it kind of lets them be knowledgeable. It gives them, you know, it accepts that they are free children doing what they want. And adults pop up and around and yet do nothing to stop these kids that are running around to their doom. And that it very much puts that element of personal responsibility onto the children. This is your responsibility. You have to look after yourself. There is nobody who will save you in these environments. And that in itself is frightening for children. That they themselves could become sucked in to a world that they couldn't get out of. And the world, all the dangers of the world are there, just ready for them. That they can't visualize the dangers before it's too late.
The entire Apache nation gathered in the hills above the headquarters of the U.S. Army in New Mexico, tired of the broken promises of the Great White Father, ready to face the Long Knives in the fort below. Kim, 8. 8 years and 3 quarters, she says. That means she's 8. Sharon, 9. Apache women weren't just squaws. They often fought too. Michael, wearing a red band. He's daft. The Apaches never wore red. Me, Geronimo, chief of the Apaches, great warrior of the plains. Tom Robert.
And that again is this theme that pops up in this Say No to Strangers in 1981. It opens with an idea of, you know, the bad guys and the good guys and how easy it is to spot on TV, you know, the sinister baddies and who they are with their music. But the reality is that there are paedophiles and sexual deviants in the world and they don't look like the bad guys, even though they can do you a lot more harm than those on TV. All this is a huge difference from the kind of things that were being shown a little bit earlier. Tufty Fluffy Tail was a character created in the 50s, 1953 in fact, who was based on trying to teach kids around road safety. Tufty's joined by Minnie Mole and Willie Weasel, as well as Mrs. Owl the teacher and a policeman Badger, and they themselves would advise kids on how not to get themselves killed on the road. In 61, the Tufty Club was set up nationwide to remind kids that they could be part of this world, that they can keep themselves safe. I am a member of the Tufty Club, therefore I know the dangers. In 73, Willie Weasel, for example, is knocked down by a car, and policeman Badger warns him not to play in the road, which at that stage would be a little bit, you know, unfortunate for Willie, because he certainly would already be in danger. It seems a huge jump then from that kind of stuff to the kind of stuff we've been talking about here. Although strictly not a public information film, The Finishing Line was created by British Transport Films to warn children of railway lines. It was broadcast on TV a number of times. And although it won awards, it was also considered to be controversial, and in the end was replaced with a slightly toned down but similar story called Robbie. The film is based in a fantasy world of a young child, where it has a headmaster telling a group of children that he knows they've been playing on the railway line. And then a young boy sits on a railway bridge and ponders what it'd be like to hold a school sports day on that line. He imagines what would happen. Competitive teams taking on different ideas and activities. You have to break through, play chicken with the trains, and throw things at the passing transport. Each time they do it, something horrendous happens. A driver and a passenger are badly injured by broken glass. After a brick is thrown through a window. The final one involves children running through a tunnel, but after they enter, we see a train approach. Only four of the children make it through to the end of the tunnel, and each of them is injured in a horrible way. The film actually ends with adults appearing to take out the bodies of these dead and injured kids, which are laid out on a long line across the railway track. And then back to this boy, who then unsurprisingly considers that it's probably not the best idea in the world to do. That film was directed by John Krish, a film director and screenwriter. He directed a lot, filmed archive footage, in particular what's known as Our School from 62, which changes the ways that schools are happening. I mean, he directed 1982's Children's Film Foundation film, Friend or Foe, which is about two lads who were evacuated from London during World War II. It's far more of an adventure, creating these two lads to be like local heroes. These shock tactics continue, though. The electricity, Don't Take a Chance run with electricity, for example, involves, well, amongst other things, a young lad climbing a pylon to a rescue of, well, not a pylon, it's like an electricity substation. And the lad spots a footy and two of them go up and they both die. And now the children, you see the burnt body of one of the kids who's been fried alive by this electricity. And then a child, and then another kid kind of going to see if he's okay and also being electrocuted. It's vicious in its tone, and it's certainly something that I remember again from the early 90s watching it. So obviously these films had kind of continued. One with a child climbing an electricity pylon to rescue a kite and then falling to his death. Although these, as I said, these public information films are no longer made by the government as such, they are made by charities and groups with interest, and we still see them to this day on various points, most notably warning people of the dangers of drink driving or not wearing a seatbelt. Most famously, I think, probably would be Charlie Says, which kind of covers a lot of these kinds of these ideas in terms of warning kids of the dangers of the world, but it's done in a far more, well, not light way, but Kenny Everett's growls as a cat and meows to warn children of the dangers. So, again, falling into water, dangers in the kitchens, playing with matches, all these things are touched on and become part of the story in terms of, in fact, it was actually referenced by The Prodigy for their Charlie Says track in the 90s. Charlie ran in the 1970s and the 80s and was extremely popular and was animated by the same people who did Crystal Tips and Alistair. So there was a degree of quality in these films. But that company also did the Protect and Survive films. Now, Protect and Survive are a little darker. Protect and Survive are essential 1970s vicious kind of public information. They are there to warn and to scare. Designed effectively to tell, advise British citizens what to do in the event of a nuclear attack. Now, Protect and Survive was, you know, it kind of refers back to, as we were talking about, the initial reason for public service and for these public service information broadcasts. They were designed to help people in a war footing. They were based on information from the 1960s to try and warn, you know, the best ways to survive what is in effect nuclear fallout. Initially designed as a brochure, a pamphlet, that was to be given out as things got a bit grim. There was also devised for TV as well, 20 short public information films produced by Richard Taylor Cartoons and narrated by the actor Patrick Allen. They are known particularly for the use of stop motion animation, illustration, voiceover narration, and a very particular electronic music phrase as well at the end to kind of tie all these things together. The cultural impact on the films, though, were far more ingrained than you think. Patrick Allen was used in some remixes of Two Tribes, obviously the Frankie Goes to Hollywood film, a song about you know, the potential for Cold War violence. Jeffrey O'Toole records a song called Protect and Serve. The Young Ones lampoon the concept of a safe form of nuclear a strike in their episode of Bomb. And it terrified people. In the Channel 4 poll for the 100 Scariest Moments, Protect and Serve came 89th, just above Dracula, the 1931 version, the Universal, the Todd Browning one. It has a very, I think one of the reasons why it works so well and is so culturally important is that people hear it and it resonates and it has a very clear and specific tone to it. It reassures that you will be okay in a situation that it would be impossible to be okay in.
And start right away making your home and your family as safe as possible from nuclear attack. Start now on your fallout room and in a refuge. Thicken the floor above your fallout room. Start blocking windows, doors, halls, passages. Thicken the outside wall if your fallout room is against it. All these things can save your life. Start now.
Where this finally gets us is the question of why. Why in this particular period of time do we have such viciousness? I think a lot of it's down to do with the times. Middle of the Cold War certainly would be a reason why we were warning everybody about the threat of nuclear annihilation. Also, the 70s were quite a paranoid time. There was fear. Fear of strangers, fear of outsiders, fear of change in the community. There was fear that the world around us was changing in a substantial and sizable way. I wouldn't be surprised if we saw that kind of stuff again now, in truth. Is it right to kind of say that the best way to get a child not to play on by an electrical pylon is to literally show a child act a death scene? I don't know. But I do know that it's seared in the mind that these films that were designed to do that, to ingrain in the mind, worked in that way, that there is now a generation of people, or more than one generation of people, who still have these kind of rather bleak memories of quite vicious violence. So I suppose the idea is that they did work. I mean, I don't know how many lives were saved due to public information films, but they certainly seared in the mind. In a sense, therefore, well, these are horror. They're horror with a purpose. They are morality tales in the oldest sense, and therefore fitting in with quite original and quite, you know, the old shorts of the of early cinema, telling people what they could and couldn't do, and you know, there was punishment if rules were impinged. That's something that sits through the horror cinema generally, but here they are writ large, a brutal blunt edge hacking away at the mind. And their effect can be seen again on things like, well, the most notable thing would be Scarfolk, a parody version of the 1970s, with a number of messages given out in public information manner. Scarfolk Council is a North West England that did not move beyond the 70s and has kind of been tinged with madness. The public information that the council continually put out is bleak, nonsensical, agitated and angry. For more, go to scarfolk.blogspot.co.uk, or, and I would recommend it, buying the book Discovering Scarfolk, the story of one man's terrible, terrible trap lying in wait within that terrible, terrible northwest town. Very funny, quite Swiftian in terms of this British kind of reflecting a British society, which I think is still there. We are scared as a nation, scared of outsiders. Our island state takes over quite a lot. And that manifests itself with fear of the community around us, fear of the outside. So it's a strange thing to be nostalgic about, but at the same time, it's something that I think we are, as a nation, still a little bit in love with.
If you have taken the advice we've been giving you recently, you will by now have chosen your fallout room and gathered your materials for an inner refuge. The time has now come to make everything ready for you and your family in case an air attack happens. This does not mean that war is bound to come, but there is a risk of this, and we must all be prepared for it. So, don't waste time. Start now.
Okay, thanks very much for that. I hope you enjoyed it. Next week, we are going to be looking at Rod Serling, who the writer who has been I've been a big fan of for a long time. And I did the Night Gallery podcast. And I spoke about Rod Serling at that point in his career, but his life is just fascinating. So we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about that. So, If you want to get hold of me, please do. My email address is thelasthorrorpodcast@gmail.com. You can go to thelasthorrorpodcast.com, leave a comment on any of the articles that are up, any of the podcasts. Or you can go to my Twitter, which is @orange_monkey. Finally, if you go to the website, you can go to the mixtape section. That's somewhere where I email out every week, a new mixtape, effectively a Spotify playlist. That's a little bit horror tinged. The last 2 weeks we've been looking at like synth, this new wave of 80s synth music that's been coming around. This week, I think we'll go back a little bit differently and look at the impact on Goblin and that kind of different kind of synth. But, you know, prog rock in a horror theme. So, you know, from how the music of films like Suspiria and of Profondo Rosso have impacted on music more generally. So, if you're interested in that, you can go to the mixtape section and I'll download and you can register and I'll send one. I'm sending one out today, but I'm also going to send out another similar kind of thing next week as well. So you won't miss out too much. Until next week then, take care and I'll speak to you soon. Goodbye.